All right, folks, we are back. We're another episode of the Lane 8 BMX podcast. And boy, I've been lucky. Let me tell you, man, I've got some good people on here. And this gentleman here, I've been meaning to talk to since I started this podcast. I've had a list of folks that I've wanted to talk to.
Wondering why I haven't been invited sooner, candidly.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Dr. Jay Richardson is on the podcast. This is a pivotal moment for me because I'm so glad to talk to this man because I find him truly inspiring. So
thank you.
Without further ado, thank you, Dr. Jay Richardson, for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast.
Thank you for having me. I was just and it is Saturday. So those of you who are not watching, I have my coffee and it's Saturday morning and I'm letting people know on my phone that I'm on a podcast now. So but I do appreciate it, and I'm glad we were able to make this happen. And yes, I was wondering why I wasn't on sooner, because I kept seeing you post and tag me in your shows, and I know you're doing the shows, and I know you do your lives, and then I'm thinking, man, why am I not? Okay. So now I feel like I'm part of the club.
Well, thank you, man. That means a lot to me, straight up, all BS aside. Yeah. Okay. I what I know is that your brother started racing first. And then you got into it.
Yep.
Talk to me about the beginnings of your racing.
Yep. So I'll tell you exactly how I recall it because I was young. So it was around 79 or 80, the year 79 or 80 with a 19 in front of it. My goodness. So anyways, my parents were divorced and we would do the back and forth thing. So my mom was in Jersey. My dad was in Vegas. We go to my dad on the summer and Christmas time and then kind of live in New Jersey. I ended up living in Vegas. My brother ended up living in Vegas too, and there was times we lived together and separately, but that's a whole nother thing. I'm just bringing that up because if we go down the road of my story, you're like, wait, I thought you said this. Anyways, long story bearable. My brother was into skateboarding. I mean, and there was a famous skate park in New Jersey called Cherry Hill Skate Park. Was famous. And so when we went to go visit my dad in Vegas, you know, they went to go check out the skate park, Desert Surf Skate Park, which was another famous skate park back in the day. Great name, by the way. And there was a BMX track next to it, Desert Surf BMX. So it was as simple as, I want to try that. Wow. And so he raced. He was a natural right from the jump. And then I feel like when we got home back to Jersey after that summer, you know, he had raced a couple times and then we got home and lo and behold, there was a track. I think it was like maybe 5 miles from our house, Egg Harbor Township, EHT. And he said, I want to race. And I remember saying, I want to race too. And I do remember my brother going, oh man, like just kind of. So and I also remember we shared a bike. So he would go, I don't even know what it was. I feel like it was a Scorpion, but maybe not. But we shared a bike. He would go race. I was pretty much walking around the track with my helmet and then he's riding around. And then like, he'd give me the bike to go race my moto or do my practice. Then I'd give it back to him. And then we went back to Vegas for Christmas and bam, opened the door. And when you walked in the door, there was like this little ledge. And then you kind of stepped down in the living room. Cause that was a thing in the '80s. And there was two bikes upside down and there was a Torker and a GT. And the Torker was his and the GT was mine. So that was the start of my racing career. But I did not care how I did. I really was just enjoying being part of it.
Yeah.
And it was what my brother was doing. He was the one that was good. He ended up like getting a co-factory sponsor with Bandito. And then next thing I know, we're flying to the Grands and he's getting picked up by Brett Allen. So basically he's riding for Mongoose. Like he was factory.
He was good.
He was good. Yeah. He won the Grands in 84.
What?
14X for real. Yeah. He's legit. And then ended up riding for Blue Max. That's kind of another funny story. I was just telling my son about that. Why he ended up riding for Blue Max, which is basically Mongoose's brand that they sold on military bases and stuff, but I still stand to this. That's like the best look and kit and uniform to this day. Anyways, so he ended up quitting racing because, I don't know, he got a license and he maybe was tired of it and didn't want the pressure of like having to keep winning or doing well, making. And by the way, his class was super hard. It was him, Carter, Hayden, King,
wow,
Veltman.
Wow.
Crazy hard class. Crazy hard class. Griffin at times. Oh. So that was that age group he was in. And so for me, and I was in New Jersey at the time, still, he was in Vegas. But then I went to go visit my dad in the summer, raced an ABA National in like, oh, so let me back up. So 1 year I was getting bored in Jersey, and then I decided to start riding to the track because, you know, the track was in a park, so it was open, but they weren't running races all year round because in New Jersey it's cold. But the weather was getting better than before the schedule allowed for races to happen. So I started riding to the track. That kind of became my thing.
5 miles away, right?
Yeah, and the first race comes up and I win. And everyone's surprised, myself included, because I didn't care. I really didn't care. Like, I was actually pretty terrible. It took me 3 years to turn expert. Wow. I was hanging out. Like, it was more like somewhat social and was just kind of like fun for me. I wouldn't say I was that competitive at a young age, but I got a taste of what that felt like. So I started doing the state series. And then we started doing a couple nationals, and I was actually terrible on the national level. I rode for Beacon, Beacon Cycler, Beacon Bikes, which was a local bike shop in the area in Jersey. And then I ended up going to Vegas before my eighth grade year and raced a national, and I made the main both wow. days in Washington. This is Gary Ellis's local track, Puyallup. Came home. So I came home back to Jersey, and, you know, word had gotten out that I'd like went to the West Coast and made a national. And then I come home with my brother's Blue Max stuff. And then I have like a new helmet, you know, those Echo helmets with that stripe that kind of went from the yeah. jaw around the top.
Yep.
And I just look, and not only that, it was black with a silver stripe, but I took the white pinstripes and I had blue. So I looked really factory, like yes. crazy factory. And, he, you know, and I was getting, and I would get mongooses because I still like had a connection, and they, you know, Dave Custodero, like he really liked my brother, but he always like flowed me bikes.
Wow.
So I looked really factory. So that coupled with, oh my gosh, he kind of represented on the West Coast. Cause the thing is, when you grew up back East, especially back then.
Yeah.
I mean, you were kind of shaking in your boots when you had to race a West Coast guy.
Yeah.
And I remember this. Oh, he's a California guy. Oh, he's a factory guy. Even if you were like a top MBL kid, when those ABA guys came over or those West Coast kids came over, it was like, whoa. Yeah. So I was like, wait, you guys are kind of, I'm still me, but I'm just tripping on my, like people in my, you know, in my chute behind the hill, like they're kind of tripping on me. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of, they're going to just like give this to me. So, you know, a little bit of foreshadowing there as it pertains to mindset and belief systems. But anyways, so I just came back crazy factory but definitely like I had a taste. And then I decided to move with my dad in the middle of eighth grade.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted to do the national circuit, and my dad, you know, having gone through it with my brother, he was kind of like, all right, well, if you want to do this, I need to see you practicing,
yeah.
Which is training. So I would ride my rollers every night. Definitely would go to the track as much as I could. And, you know, that was the dream, was to go to nationals and be a factory kid. Cause I really hadn't had that. You know, I've had a lot of help along the way, but I wasn't like the factory kid.
Yeah.
Then it started happening. I was making a lot of mains, winning a couple here and there. My class was super hard too. Me, Nelson, Romero, DeBacker, Owens, Green, Shelby James. You know, so that's seven dudes.
Yeah.
Okay. Not to mention like Bittner, what's it? Not Fink. Yeah, Fink, Hale. Like all the other digit, like it just keeps going, like with people, you know, that, you know, Luna sometimes would cross in there, and but there was, I mean, it was very, very competitive, my class.
Yeah.
Anyways, so, but it started to happen. So I got on Razorback, which was kind of, so Diamondback kind of disbanded a lot of their team and all they kept was Charles and Matt. I got on Razorback, which was Brandon Allen and John Malone and myself and, you know, Jason Johnson. That's a name. And then I got on LNS, which was the guy who, well, you know, he was boss, but then he started his own company, LNS. And then at that point when I got on LNS, now I'm teammates with Sveltman, Darren Mitchell, Vergara, Roebuck, Romero. Steve had moved to Vegas by then, Veltman. And he actually taught me how to get a gate start. So I went this whole time, basically until 16 that I actually learned how to get a gate and like when to go on the gate. I was just kind of like guessing the whole time.
Okay, hold on. Let me ask you this. Were you a bit surprised at the how it just kind of flowed for you after that?
It didn't flow for me. Dude, it seems like it flowed for me, but it did not flow for me. It did not flow for me at all. I had come so close so many times. Cause I was in the mains, but I mean, to get a factory ride that you, I mean, it was Charlie Davidson. That was another kid in my class, rode for Repcor. So to get a factory ride as a kid, it wasn't just making the mains. It was getting top three because you needed to be valuable for those team sheets. Yeah. And back then, the kids on those factory teams made money.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yes. They would split the team. Like, they would win team sheets and make money. Like, George Severs, I went to high school with George Severs.
Yeah.
He bought Jason Donnell, he bought Jeff Donnell's, his brother's truck.
Yeah.
He was 14 and had this really badass mini truck in his garage that he was like, they were just waiting for him to drive when he was 16. Yeah. It was just sitting in his garage. It was like laced too. It was like in magazines, this, that, and the other. So, and that's all from team money. You know, Danny Nelson, you know, brilliant, right? But he'd been a factory rider ever since he was a kid, and his dad would put that money away. I mean, I think he went like something crazy, like 90% down on the first house he bought. Matt Hayden was making money as an amateur. So anyways, yeah, some of them were getting salary as amateurs.
What?
But a lot of these guys were getting definitely like the GTs, the Robinsons, the, you know, they would get, so they'd win team sheet and that would be whatever amount of money there was. And some of these teams would split the money between the riders. Like if a factory ride back then, plane ticket shows up, you get cash for how much money you have to spend to eat. And then if you do team sheet, then you get another bump after that.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
man.
Insane, man.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
So, well, now you know.
Yeah, I do.
So it, getting on a factory team was very difficult, especially when we're talking a GT, a Haro, a Robinson, a Diamondback. Yeah. So I remember I won a race. In Ventura. I won Cruiser. I beat Charlie Davidson, who was like a factory guy. And then Harry Leary was at the finish line. He's like, hey, dude, you know, just kind of chatted me up. He's like, hey, if I gave you a bike, would you ride it? At that time, I'm riding in a Mongoose uniform, not a factory uniform. My jersey definitely said racing team.
Yeah.
Not factory team. And I said, sure. And so I'm thinking, okay, this is it. And I went like a good most of that year, kind of like just, you know, very close to getting that ride, but it never happened because I even write about it in my book. I just wasn't winning enough. Justin Green was in my class too, even though he was older. So he would age out and I would kind of, we'd cross over, but then we'd split. But they picked up another younger guy because he was winning more consistently and he didn't race Justin. But that's how competitive it was. Like I was making mains, but not winning enough.
Yeah.
And when I say winning, I mean first place enough.
Yeah.
Get it?
Yeah.
So it's like, it wasn't that it flowed. I'm just kind of speed fast tracking us through the stories of the factory teams. Like, oh yeah, I was hurt when that didn't happen. Like I was hurt. Like, yeah. Cause Harry, and he was great. I mean, he gave me the bike and, you know, he was super cool. But you know, he had to make the right decision for the team, and he did. Yeah. He did. Anyway, so I ended up getting on Razorback, right? Because him giving me that nod, I was in that, now I was in that window of that sphere of like, okay, well, this, you know, because the guy who created Razorback was making the helmets and the pedal cages, and he was the grandfather of the young kid on the team, Jason Johnson.
Wow.
So he created his own factory team. I was a natural pick.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom. Then I started riding for LNS, and that was kind of a dream team in a, as a kid, because my best friends were on it, Darren and Greg, Darren Mitchell and Greg.
Yeah.
And Steve Veltman. And Steve was like, to have him live in Vegas at the time, he'd like, because his dad moved to Vegas, so he went to go live with him for a couple years, but to just do sprints in his yard and learn how to get gates and just be kind of, you know, talked up like, no, yeah, you can do that. No, you can do that. And this is how, I mean, all those kind of little things that I didn't know from a racecraft style.
Yeah.
Steve Veltman helped me. So that's where I became consistent and started winning. Then I go to Colorado, a national in Colorado. And this one kid who rides for Auburn, I noticed wasn't on Auburn anymore. And it always tripped me out, because it's like, this kid was, he was good, but like, he definitely wasn't, you know, at the caliber I thought, like, because Auburn was basically GT.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, long, you know, keeping going, Bill Grad, who worked for ODI, I said, hey, Bill, like, you know, Jason Jeffaloni's not on Auburn anymore. You think you could talk to, he's like, I know TC, blah, 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 Florida. Right. And then Bill introduces me to TC, and, you know, TC is crazy cool. I look up to him, right? It's like Todd Corbett, Zell Wood, E-Team, blah, all this stuff. And we met, and I used to carry around my tapes, like Walkman and my music.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're just sitting in the stands like, oh, what you listening to? And I'm like, oh, this. And then I open my tapes, and it's like a lot of like 80s new wave kind of stuff.
Yes, sir.
You know, with some of the obscure stuff, a few classic, you know, hip hop things, but, you know, but mainly like that was my stuff. And he was just like, oh my gosh, this is great. Because I had an older brother, I was like, that's what I was turned on to. I wasn't even listening to that much music of my time as much as it was like prior. So my music got me on the team, because they were leaving for tour in 2 weeks, Auburn. And I wanted that right. Anyways, long story short, I was just on hype. So I won. I like doubled one day, and then I won 3 out of 4 mains that weekend in Colorado. I'm riding home and I'm just happy. And then 2 weeks later, Auburn van shows up in front of my house.
Wow.
With bike, with uniform. Like all I did was pack my music. I packed my music and my clothes, and they showed up, and everything. Basically, TC had just went shopping for me at the factory and brought everything there.
Okay.
And then I was on tour at 16.
When you see
that's when 16. It started.
Okay. When you see that, you walk out your house, you see all of this, what's going through your mind? Because that's gotta be an ego boost for a 16-year-old kid.
Dude, let me tell you something. So, and living in New Jersey, okay, and kind of being close to it, but then not really. But seeing the magazines and seeing the palm trees, and then reading the articles of the world championships, or reading the articles of this summer tour, that summer tour, what this team's doing, and they're going to this track and the clinics, and like, I wanted that so much. And then all of a sudden, I'm doing it. Like, it,
wow,
it's happening. And I just remember, yeah, I mean, it couldn't get any better for a 16-year-old. I mean, I was on cloud nine. And then, so we drive to Utah, do a clinic. And then we ended up making our way to Rockford through Nebraska, hang out with Greg Grubbs, like just doing clinics along the way. And go to Rockford. And I Rockford's like my track.
Yeah.
Just full power, first straight. I think I won maybe 2 out of 4 classes, and then boom, like a couple months later, I get the cover of the BMXer, and I'm just, it's me going over the first, the drop, with, you know, pretty good lead over Rana and DeBakker. But it was just like, it was cool. It was like, I had arrived, you know? So not only am I on the factory team, I'm performing, I'm getting coverage. Like, it was crazy. It was crazy.
When you see yourself on the cover of a magazine, what went through your mind there? Because that's got to be wow.
We'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. I mean, it was like, it was a bit surreal.
Yeah.
It was a bit surreal because, you know, I remember a couple years before that, flying to a race with my buddy, and we're going to the Christmas Classic, and we're looking through the magazine on the plane, deep in coach. And I'm just like, and I remember I had my headphones on and he had his headphones, but we're like sharing the magazine, looking through, and there's a picture of Charlie Davidson. I'm like, and I just look at him. I just kind of used hands. I was like, yo, I'm going to be that dude. I'm beating him. Right. I'm getting there. And my buddy was like, yeah, right. I was like, okay. But it was cool because at that point he's like, you did it. You know, like that was the cool part is, you still go back to your local track.
Yeah.
You know, you still go home. Yep. And when you go home and, you know, the kids you ride with and the kids you race and because we're all kids, but it's different, right?
Yeah.
You're same, but different at that point. And then it's like, you know, and don't get me wrong. Like they treated me the same. They still made fun of me the same way. They still gave me shit the same way. They still made fun of my mistakes the same way. But at the same time, there was like, there was an implicit respect there. But not only that, it wasn't even about that. It was just like, I was living the life that I wanted to live. I wanted to be the factory dude. And I wanted to be in the, you know, and I wanted to be on tour and all that stuff. And I was able to do that. And I was motivated at that point to win. Just, you know, like I was going for the title, period. Like I was like, I remember going, it got to the point where I was going to the Nationals. And I was like, if I got second, I was just like, oh, that was a wasted weekend. Cause in ABA, you get rewarded for winning one, but two is it's based on your rider count for the overall amateur title. And I remember I needed six wins to even kind of throw my name in the hat. Cause I actually had a somewhat lowish rider count compared to other classes. But I remember coming home, you know, it was not for me. It wasn't, I'm not gonna say it wasn't successful, but it wasn't a valuable weekend for me if I were editing it first because of the points.
Okay, how did you hearing that at a six, hearing that from someone who was at 16 years old in that position? How did you handle the pressure? Because I know there's external pressure, but there's also pressure from you to hear.
So
saying that it was a kind of a wasted weekend for
seconds. Yeah. So it's a trip, and I remember going into. So I had some wins, and I remember going into Coal Canyon, which is the Fall Nationals, and that's a big one. And I won 16 and over open, and it's a local race for the GT firm, right? They have like a big setup, and I remember winning. I was winning class, my main event, and then someone T-boned me, stupid move, and I crashed. So I blew that win. But I did have six wins, but I wanted the Coal Canyon win because I had a big rider count.
Yeah.
So it was funny in the Nationals that the pressure was kind of there, but I think, and I talk about this now, it's like, because my bar was so high and I was willing to live up to it. Yeah. There was more, I was in control of that pressure more, right? I was in control of that pressure. It was like, it's what I wanted. It was like fully like, it was all about my agency versus I have to do this because it's expected of me and all these people think blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Get it? So it's a bit different. Now, heading into the Grands that year, going for my first title, that was, you know, granted, high standard.
Yeah.
But then I did feel it because I remember. So at this point, they had changed the gate. They raised it.
Wow.
And I was kind of like, okay with it, but I had to, you know, my typical start was not able, I wasn't able to do that.
Yeah.
And my class was hard. I mean, so Romero was in that main, Nelson was in that main, Dylan Clayton was in that main, Roger Holder was in that main. It was a hard main. And it was funny because I had a mathematical shot at the title.
Yeah.
But a lot of things needed to happen because, again, my rider count was, but it started to happen. Okay. So-and-so crashed and so-and-so crashed. And then I remember like being behind the gate and we're watching, I think Mike Luna crashed and Romero, man, this is a homie right now, right? Like he looks at me, he's like, dude, you can still get the title. And we're like both in the main, like this is at the main event at the Grands and they're behind the gate. And he's like, dude, you can still win the title.
Wow. That's your boy.
I'm like, but I'm thinking, hey, that's all right. I was like, well, at least I know I'm probably going to beat you this weekend.
Yeah.
But, you can look that main event up. I don't win. I was winning, but if you watch how I ride, I'm riding nervous. I'm riding tight. And it's like back and forth. Like I'm riding to win, but I'm also riding nervous and tight. And I'm definitely, you know, and I lost at the line. I got second. So I ended up winning age group number one. Roger Holder ended up winning the main and he should have. He was the faster guy.
Yeah.
But I didn't get amateur. And Zach Roebuck got the amateur title that year. And he was like, he came like kind of out of the, I don't want to say out of the stands, but it was kind of like a,
wow,
again, a weird, weird setup. So anyways,
how did you handle that loss?
I was pretty deflated.
Yeah. I would think so.
I was pretty deflated. And the reason why was because ABA had changed their class structure.
Yeah.
So I was 17 expert. The year before there was a 17 and over expert. So that's why my rider count was kind of, you know, but I knew as I aged up, I'd have even less, like the rider count would change. And I knew I wouldn't have the opportunity to get that title.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of like, whatever. And this is funny. Like I remember getting NAG one and it was like, like I was like, because it was about back then, it was about amateur number one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it was just like, I don't think I remember even running a one.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy.
Wow.
And so, now I'm a senior in high school and I'm riding for Auburn and things are good. So this is so funny, right? So I remember going, I go to Reno and I win open both days and I kind of, you know, do pretty good in class. I'm like, so now it's just like, whatever. You're pretty funny, right? Like I went from just like wanting it to now I'm there and I'm like, whatever. But that tells you how important it is to have a direction and a North Star, right?
Yes, sir.
And it also tells you how important it is, how crazy it is, how much you can get used to something, anything. So I decided to turn pro my senior year. Not many people know that I turned pro my senior year, but I turned pro my senior year of high school because I knew I was going to college and pretty much the messaging was, how are you going to race and go to college? Da, 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 da.
Yes.
And I figured, okay, I might as well just turn pro and, you know, turn pro. And then just to say I turned pro, race single A, make a few bucks here and there. You remember there's two levels of pro.
Yeah. April.
Yeah. Yeah.
Double A.
So just make a few bucks here and there and then, you know, whatever. So that's what I did. And I really had a very, by the way, it was hard. Like I was racing Alan Foster and, you know, a lot of men who were kind of either career single A's or on their way to double A and taking it seriously. Right. They weren't in college. They were like paying rent or had a real job, you know? So, I definitely learned a lot of hard lessons. I was okay.
That's what I was going to ask you.
I was okay. Hard? Yeah. Well, I wasn't that directed. I was just like, oh, you know, so when I turned single A, I was kind of like, you know, I just didn't have the race sense. I didn't have the sense of intensity or intention there. Yeah. I was just kind of there to be there. Graduate high school. And then I then I go to college. And Auburn's like, well, we only have enough for 5 races for you. I'm like, damn, that's not that much. And I'm thinking, okay, well, me getting a part-time job in school is going to suck. Like, that just sucks.
Yeah.
That ain't happening. And I have 5 races. And I'm like, all right, 5 races? Okay, let's go. And then it was on. So the goal was turn double A within those 5 races.
So there was a certain amount of money.
Now I got a North Star again, and now I have some intention.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, first race of the year, made some mains, nothing. Danny Nelson had turned pro by then. He was dominating A pro. Like, he turned pro a year after me, but he, you know, he had a very clear career path.
Yeah.
And then Phoenix came up, and it was a rain weekend. And I always did good at Phoenix. And I remember winning Sunday. And then I was like, okay, now we're turned on. And that single A pro win was $1,000. Like, or 900. It was like $900 in cash in my hand. And then Bakersfield comes up. And this is like spring break. Driving to Bakersfield, I have like maybe a couple $100 in my bank account. I ride for Auburn. So luckily I have a place to stay and I have rental fees. I remember getting a ticket on the way to Bakersfield. And then I got first and second in Bakersfield.
Okay, hold on. Let me ask you this. That Sunday at in Phoenix, what did you do different before?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a switch that flipped. And I honestly, if I look back to it, it was just like, I think I made the main the day before. But I know I won on Sunday on the mud day.
Yeah.
And it was a long track and it was muddy. But I just remember digging in that day. Like, just digging in. And I just, for whatever reason, the way I was able to power through that first straight was just really good. Like, I don't even know if I could have won that day if it would stay dry.
It's a long,
but just something
straight.
Something about that was just like, you know, I'm winning today. Right. So all I had to do was like, keep doing the same thing. And then the switch was flipped. Yeah. And then it's like, okay, Bakersfield, I get a first and second. So now I'm $300 shy from turning double A.
Yeah.
And El Paso's next. And I've historically done well at El Paso as an amateur and even as a pro, like any single A pro. So I have one, and this is my last race for Auburn, my 5th race. So instead of going there as a single A, I bump myself up to double A. Because I figure, well, if they're going to pay for 5 races, they're going to pay for this last one as a double A, and I'm going to show my worth.
Yeah.
Get on the gate. So this is back when they ran Pro Open, and Pro Open was before class. But I remember being next to between Pete Longkarevich and Charles Townsend.
Wow.
I'm 6 foot, but those dudes are taller than me or just as big as me. So yeah. I'm kind of crapping myself, honestly.
Wow.
But El Paso hadn't raised their gate. So I was able to get like my normal, and their gate was like a little forward. It was an open angle.
Yeah.
And those dudes were still getting like traditional, I call them old school gates. And I was kind of that lift up the wheel and just charge out on the top end.
Yeah.
So I'd get a lot of hole shots. Anyways, I ended up winning that moto, and that gave me a little bit of confidence for the rest of the weekend. I ended up making my mains, like double A and A and single A. Now I was getting beat up a little bit too. Like, you know, like even TC, my teammate, he gave me a little bit of business in the corner. I'm like, okay, like there was a lot of lessons to learn for sure. But I made my mains. And so it was like, dang, like, okay. Now, Auburn still dropped me. They didn't drop me, but they just said, you know, look, we'd love for you to still ride the stuff, but we don't have the budget for you. And I'm looking at this going, all right, well, the end of school's coming up. I'm not going back to Vegas to work construction for my dad. I'd want to stay out here and race. So I talked my dad into buying me 2 plane tickets, one to some race in San Antonio or something. And then another one was Rockford.
Yeah.
So San Antonio comes up, I race, I make a main or two. I maybe come home with $300-$400. I'm like, oh, that's rough. But then I have a ticket to Rock. And then that's the race where TC gets hurt, his career ending injury. But by then I had already started to ride for TNT. I took a ride with TNT.
Yep.
So crazy how this worked, because had I stayed on Auburn, like that would have been, I would have taken his spot.
Oh,
but
okay.
Yeah, I'm not a future teller. And TNT was awesome. Like they came in. So when you talk about flow, that's where it flowed, because Alan Foster left TNT because him and his brother were blowing up on Airwalk. And then that left room for me for TNT. You see what I'm saying? And then, anyways, so Rockford comes up, and remember, that's my track.
Yeah.
So I went there. And again, that was the, I still had that flat turn last turn. And I remember Mike King teaching me how to go around flat turns, but I made the mains, got a couple top threes, came home with $1,000, and then it was able to call the travel agent. We're talking early 90s.
Yeah.
Use that money to get to the next race, begged my friend to like stay in his attic that summer and just use the money I made racing to go to the next race. And then ended up number 7 that year in ABA pro.
That's a tough way to go about it.
Yeah. And then, but then TNT stepped up. They were like, okay, you know, like they basically covered my entries. And that was pretty much it the first year. And then the second year was like everything. It was like travel, entries, a little bit of cheddar on the for monthly. And then, then it started getting real. Had some success, won the world championships, 94, yep. Made cruiser, both my right? main. So I won cruiser, made my main in 20 inch. So, I'm a player essentially. Like I'm a guy, I'm a double A pro straight yes, up. Sir. And then, and then I got word through Bill Grad from ODI. He's passed away, like 6 or 7 years, but he's like, hey, you know, he would get the trade papers and the trade magazines. He's like, yeah, I think Giant is getting in the game. And so he helped me with a proposal and I sent that off to Giant and they loved it. And then boom, like just, you know, now I'm. Yeah. So I signed a deal with them.
Hold on. How was that? Because you had TNT that stepped up
mm-hmm.
and then you saw the opportunity with Giant. Mm-hmm. How did you break it to?
So TNT? Mark at TNT was cool. Like, cause TNT, you know, they've been kind of a staple. I mean, they're, I don't want to call them a mom and pop shop, but a boutique brand, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
High end components, but they're not a GT or a Giant or a Haro. I mean, they weren't a big company like that.
Yeah.
So Mark was cool. I mean, they were family. Like he was like, he kind of heard rumblings cause you know, it's a small world, but he was great. I mean, he let me leave early because I remember riding for Giant in October. I started riding for them at the Fall Nationals. That was my coming out. Lynn Casson was making my bikes or the bikes for a while for us. But Mark was awesome. I mean, he knew. He's like, you know, it's kind of like you're not going to. Yeah, he wasn't going to compete with that. I mean,
yeah,
this is a company that paid people hundreds of thousands of dollars to ride for them. You're not going to. TNT wasn't going to do that.
Okay,
you know,
let me ask you then.
So I'll put it this way. So Danny Nelson won 20 inch at the Worlds and I won cruiser at the Worlds. So the two youngest guys won both pro classes at the Worlds, right? My bonus, and I'm not, and this is not to disparage them. It is not. My bonus, he was like, hey, you can either have this amount of money or you can get, we'll give you a mountain bike. And I was happy and grateful, but I know Danny's bonus on, I think he was riding for Powerlite at the time, maybe Robinson. I know his bonus was at least 5 or 10 grand for that win.
Wow.
Right. And mine was like, you know, maybe $1,000, $1,200 for TNT. And it's nobody's fault. It's just, that's the level of company. Right.
Yeah.
And so me riding for Giant puts me on par with like a GT. Well, actually even I didn't even know, cause I was ignorant at the time. Right. Right. I probably, looking back, I probably could have asked for double or triple the first time out, just not knowing. I didn't know, but whatever. But now my bonuses are like 10 grand and like salaries stupid, like so I remember my mail would still get, a lot of my mail would still get sent to my dad's office.
Yeah.
And so I'm in college still, and so I go home for Christmas and Giant hadn't gotten me in their system just yet. A lot of this stuff is analog back then.
Yeah.
And I said, well, just send But they're like, hey, we owe you money because you've been with us for 3 months. And we actually owe you. We got to pay you. I said, just send it to Vegas because I'm going to Vegas for Christmas. My dad always opened my mail. Well, sounds fair like enough. Mom. I mean, fair enough. Fair enough. Right. And especially back then, because it's like I'm in college. He's paying for college. It's like, well, why don't you know, like, you know, privacy schmimacy. I'm paying for some of this. But and he's nosy. So he opened my mail and then he was just like, he's like, this company pays you this much money to ride a bike. I'm like, yeah. So that was that. And it's interesting. So at that point, it was pretty cool. Like that was the point where I started to really become more self-sufficient too, which was nice. So
a grown ass man.
Well, when I went to college and you know, I'll be real. My parents paid for college. And they were actually like, you know, good with, you know, they had money to pay for me to be in school, to be away for school. But it was nice because other than tuition, like I was paying my rent, I was paying, okay. I was starting to like pay everything else.
Yeah.
Like it just happened naturally, you know, which was cool. Yeah. And so when I graduated college, like that summer, end of that summer, I remember buying a house. Like I bought a house. Yeah. And I had enough land for trails and I had a little track in the yard and I'm living in Cali and I'm driving a Range Rover and unreal.
Don't try to slide that in. Don't try to slide. I'm driving a Range Rover. What?
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah.
That's crazy, dude. Okay. Let me ask you something. I'm curious about this. You started riding for Giant. They had no knowledge of building a BMX bike.
Mm-mm.
So who was building your bike and how did you feel
about
that?
Okay. So here's the thing. So they were paying the best mountain biker at the time, which was John Tomac.
Yes.
Okay. Cool story. He was teammates with my brother on Mongoose.
Wow.
He stayed at my house in the 80s when my brother's was teammates with him.
Wow. That's cool.
Fast forward to, you know, 1995 or six, 10 years later, I'm teammates with this guy, kinda. But Lynn Kasten, who started Redline, was making John's race frames.
Okay, so you're good.
He was making a lot of bikes for Giant, especially on the high end. So it was a no brainer to have him make the BMX bike.
Okay.
And so I learned a lot because I went from Auburn to TNT and I got on that TNT and that was a much better bike for me because it was longer. The bottom bracket was like in the right spot, blah, blah, blah. Like it, that bike was dope.
Yeah.
And I did good on the croupy because the croupy was a lot like the TNT.
Yeah.
Relaxed seat angle, long front end, you know, all that stuff. And Kasten's bike's kind of the same thing. So he's like, well, what do you like? And I'm like, well, I like this. I said, but I got to say, you know, so it was pretty cool to talk with the people at Giant and talk with Lynn and kind of design something for me, but then kind of design something for the general population and pick colors. And I remember I was like, no, we got to do matte black. Like nobody did a matte black bike.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, we got to do matte black. And so we did the matte black. Boom. Even with TNT, like I was like, Mark, we got to do a yellow bike. I want a yellow bike. He's like, man, I don't want. Why do you want a yellow bike? I'm like, dude, trust me, we got to do a yellow bike. Got a yellow bike. Did the answer catalog. Man, they sold so many. They sold so many yellow bikes.
Are you serious?
Yeah, he was against it, and I'm like, no, it's gonna pop. And then sure enough, like people were on it. So I got to work with Giant on developing a frame. And I learned a lot from Lynn. And Lynn, so I'm in San Diego at school.
Yep.
And Lynn is like down the road, his kind of factory office, all that other stuff. And we did like a lot of press stuff with them to kind of announce the relationship. Because the trade publications, that was important, you know, that Lynn was building the bikes and that this brand was being developed. Mosh was being developed by, you know, had like a legitimate AA pro and like this guy with all this legacy and BMX and blah, 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 blah. So my bikes were dope. And then eventually Giant started making the bikes.
Yeah.
There might even been a lawsuit.
How did that go though?
It actually went well because I would drive up to Giant quite a bit. Cause my relationship, you know, with everyone in there, I mean, they were great, but I loved going in there. And like, so here's the cool part. So you go into Giant and it's an office, you know, and there's bike stuff in the front, but then you go in the back, right? Yeah. And in the back, there's this room. And I had a special like set, there's like a special section, and then, but there was like a special section, I don't say for me, but definitely like for team stuff.
Yeah.
But it was cool. I'd go back to Giant and I'd go in the back where all the product guys were and the product managers and all that stuff. And you'd see like other people's bikes cut in certain sections and ways. You'd see other products, like you'd see all kinds of stuff that would never hit the market, like stuff they were prototyping. Yeah. And then there was like, then there was a couple bins that was like Mark BMX, Jason, like kind of like my, yeah, pretty sweet. That's and so fair. I'm getting, so I remember I was like the first in BMX to run V brakes.
Really?
Yeah, I was one of the first people to get the DXR brakes. I wasn't clipped in. So, but yeah, I was the first to run the, I was running the prototype Anser Alumilite fork.
Yeah.
And then the first to get the carbon fork.
Wow.
And the mag fork. Berm banger pants. Remember those?
Oh my
God. I got one of the first cuts of those. So riding for Giant kind of raised the bar.
Yeah.
Not just from a racing standpoint, but from an industry standpoint. Cause I'm like really seeing kind of different levels of how this works and understanding how a little bit of the purchasing works and then the OE deals and how that affects sponsorship. Yeah. And it's like, okay. And then I'm kind of learning how all that works.
I would say at the same time, you're also seeing where BMX, the direction it's going.
So, yeah. So, right. So Giant's in, Trek's in, Gary Fisher's in, Diamondback is back in.
Yeah.
Specialized is in, Marin tries to get in to BMX. So this is a lot of craziness going on, right? Meanwhile, you know, X Games is starting to come up.
Yep.
There's Crank TV. NBL has ESPN Road to Glory. So we have some TV. We're doing our thing. Where it started to split was when the dirt jumping stopped happening at the BMX races.
Yeah.
And then X Games was kind of like, well, we want the dirt jumping and the freestyle, not so much the racing. We still had our own series, so we were doing good, but that's where we started to see people really splinter off and having to choose, you know, because remember, Brian Foster was a racer and dirt jumper. Yep. And then eventually it was like, yeah, I'll just kind of focus on this.
Yeah. Do you think it hurt BMX because of the split?
I remember telling Bob Tedesco saying, "You, no matter what you do, we try to keep those dirt jumpers at the races." Because one, it was just a good vibe. Like,
Yeah. You
know, it gave people something to do and see at the races. Yeah. But two is it made it a little bit more of a festival atmosphere versus just a race atmosphere. And it kept people together. And, you know, it was a better snowball, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, anyways. So it hurt a bit. I mean, what hurts racing is that it's just hard. It's just hard. Like as a competitor to race, I mean, you really have to be okay with, I mean, really okay with just getting beat because the success rate is so low in BMX racing.
Yeah.
Whereas in dirt jumping or street or park or any of those things, you may not be able to do what Corey Anastasio does, but you can still do it at your level by yourself, you know, by yourself or on your own. And it's not like the gate drops and you get smoked.
Yeah.
Like you can still hit that six pack, those doubles, and look cool and have it feel good. Even if you don't do a backflip, like just jumping them's cool.
Yeah.
Right. You know, crossing it up, maybe a little whip. You don't have to do some 360 flare, blah, blah, blah. Right. And that's just like on a casual, non-competitive,
yeah,
kind of thing. But in BMX racing, like there's a start and finish line. And so if you're not about that, then it's easy to kind of just bow out of that and move towards something else that's more at your own pace.
Yeah. When did you first clip in?
So
And your thoughts?
I officially first clipped in. I know this. I tried it and didn't like it at a couple places, but I don't think I even finished the weekend. But I officially first clipped in, I want to say Salt Lake, Rad Canyon, probably 2001.
Wow.
2000 or 2001. And I remember that because I was one of the last to clip in. And I remember John Smart, Australian guy,
yeah,
called me a dinosaur. Anyways,
not cool.
Whatever. He was kind of right. But we can look at the career longevity and see who was what. Okay. So
yes.
But he was right. so that's when I clipped in and I made my mains and I'm like, all right, probably should, give this a look. And because I remember going, like, I was still like in Europe traveling and racing a bit. So I rode for a French team for a while and I was still one of the few guys in flats. And then I clipped in. Yeah.
Okay. You ended up leaving Giant.
So my thoughts on that, thoughts on that were, at the time, my thoughts were, I really wanted AA to at least be on flat pedals. I felt like don't get me wrong. Like, clips are an advantage. They are. Not for the upstroke or anything, but just because you're attached to the pedal, like, you're going to be more efficient. But I just felt like, I didn't like how it made us, like, for me, it didn't make me that much faster, but it made a slower guy that much faster.
So a donkey to a racehorse.
Correct. Which is like, yeah, like, my improvement was like marginal, but for the other guy, it was like really big.
Yeah.
Just like, whatever. That's my own stuff I had to work through, but I wanted it to be like Major League Baseball. It's like, well, they use aluminum bats, but not in Major League Baseball. That's where I was kind of going with it, but nobody, I understood why. I mean, it's BMX was the Wild Wild West and still is a bit.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that I don't think clips are the reason why, when people are on the message boards talking about, oh, clips ruin the sport. It's like, they did mess with the style and the look of it a bit, because a lot of it has become a bit homogenized.
Yeah.
But it is, they are better to ride in / race in. Oddly enough, they're actually better suited for BMX racing than they are even mountain biking.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the irony. Especially the way the tracks have gone. And that's the other thing, like, but the tracks are built in the US to get through 200 plus motos efficiently. So it's kind of this, part of it's just the nature of the beast. Anyways,
You ended up leaving Giant to ride for Croupy. Mm-hmm. Why? Because I
didn't end up leaving Giant to ride for Croupy.
You didn't.
I got dropped from Giant. Yeah, I got dropped from Giant end of 99 because, they were going a different direction. And it was Mosh, right? So that was a funny brand because Mosh, like Mosh Pit, blah, blah, blah. And I was like bleaching my hair and doing all this stuff. So I kind of looked the part, but I'm not that punk rock.
Yeah.
Really, Neil Wood probably would have been the person to fit that mold better, or Adam Richards, or somebody with just a little bit more hard edge. That said, they were looking to go they had Jerry Bagley and they were looking to go they had Mike Ardeline. So they were kind of leaning towards street, park, dirt, jump kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And that's where the money was flowing too. And they were kind of leaning towards more parts and accessories. So I got dropped. And I was at the top end of the pay. I'm sure I was getting paid the most, probably, from a rider perspective on the BMX side. So then I was sponsor-less for a little bit. And then I rode for Bulldog.
Yeah.
Before we started recording, I rode for Bulldog, and Jimmy gave me a good look and helped me out. And so that I worked to deal with Bulldog and Vans and the Source. And he had a connection with the Source magazine. And then I just went to Vans and was like, yo, you guys want to get in an urban market? Boom. Check this out. And they were like, give him what he wants. So Vans was basically covering entry fees and some travel expenses, because like my jersey was different than the rest of the Bulldog team.
Yeah.
Because it had a big Vans logo, but they wanted to get in the urban market. And guess what? got my Vans on, but they like it ended up coming through. I'm not saying I'm the reason for it, but my point is it did end up, they did end up getting in the urban market. So that's how that deal worked. And then went to the bike show, ran into a guy who I knew from going to the Worlds in France in like 97. Oh, I have a brand. You should ride. You know, he's like, will you ride? If I bring you to France, will you wear my uniform? I'm like, yeah, why not? So I ended up going to France for a couple races wearing his uniform. And then that ended up turning into like a sponsor for a couple years, B52. And they made parts and accessories. And then I rode for MCS as the frame. But during this time, I was really starting to come back up again, like my results and on a world level, like making some world main events. And then Krupe called kind of. And I remember being at the Grands pretty much after I made my AA main, the owner of Krupe, it was so sweet, like old guy, nice guy, Benny. He just, you know, Christian had already decided to write. He was on the team, Christian Bessarina. He was already on for the next year. And then he's like, yeah, we were discussing it. We really like to have you on the team. You think you'd like to ride for us? I'm like, you know, now I'm Eddie Murphy in Trading Space. I'm like, yeah, I believe I can hang with you fellas for a while. And it was just so cool to go into the main, like knowing my next year is solid.
Yeah.
And Krupe was legit too, because the bike, you know, so all these deals that I pieced together, I mean, you know, God bless Brian Fell and DeVito for really like putting something together. But that bike, as great as the Speed Freak was, it was like the back end was short, like a little short, so I needed more back end, but this Krupe bike fit me so well, and it was light, and I mean, it just went together really well. And then that's when we started getting this flow back, and then then me and Christian just went on a tear. Like, there wasn't a main we couldn't make, straight up. Worlds, boom, in there. Cruiser, in there. 20 inch, in there. Like double, you know, NBL, ABA, boom, we're in the mains. We're in the mains. We're in the mains. I'm even getting some wins. I'm going for the NBL title. The next year, he's going for the NBL title. And then we both, you know, he ends up getting a call from free agent. I end up getting a call from Haro. And then boom, we're like, bang, we're like corporate again.
Yeah.
Just like that. And then,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but this entire time, you're going to school. So
I went to school. I came to San Diego in 92, fall of 92. Yeah. Graduated in 5 years, not four, because I was racing. So I just, God bless my dad. I'm like, this is me being like dumb kid. Like, I had no idea how much school was, let alone a private Jesuit university. I mean, I knew how much it was, but I didn't really understand what that was for him to write that check for tuition.
Yes, sir.
That last year. I wasn't going to do school in the summer because I was racing and traveling. And so Giant was great. I had it in my contract that my racing and duties were not to interfere with school. And you know, candidly, there were some things I just didn't do because of school, some, but not many.
Yeah.
I graduated in 97 college. Then I went to get my MBA in 98, but that was more like night school. So what I was sacrificing was going to the track on Wednesday nights, but there was in California, you still have like a Tuesday night and a Thursday night and a Saturday and a Sunday. So I did that. And that was awesome, cause I was riding for Giant. So I was just like paying cash for school, just writing checks.
Wow.
Boom, 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 boom. And interesting story. They also paid for my membership at the gym. And I remember I just paid for 3 years up front. And I just expensed it. And it was a lump sum. Just easy for them. Like, boom. Yeah. They paid for my trainer. Like, it was crazy. It was crazy. And then I graduated with my MBA in 2000, and then I didn't go to any school, and I'm just kind of like living and buying houses and selling houses. And, you know, I meet my wife and get married. And then around, I break my leg in 2006.
That's right.
February 2006. And then I decide to race again. And then my second or third race back, I'm sitting next to a couple, and they're a psychologist couple, therapist couple. And we just get to talking on the plane, and I'm thinking, oh man, like how long does it take to go to school, and what degree do you have, and licensure? I'm just trying to figure out their world. And then it's like dawning on me, like, this is the perfect business model for me. Not because it's like, well, yes, it's a great way to make a living, but it's also fits my personality. I'd work with a sports psychologist. Like, it just fits so well. And I figured I could be the action sports dude or race guy or whatever, but it would allow me to do a lot of different things. And so I was back in school, January 2007, doctored in 2010, retired racing in 2008. Yeah, doctored in 2010, licensed in 2011, on the plane to the Olympics in 2012, working with a couple athletes.
Okay. How was the transition for you from retirement to going into all of this?
So pretty.
Was it difficult?
It was rough and easy. So rough emotionally.
Okay.
Right. Rough emotionally because, yeah, you are leaving something that you've done your whole time. You are no longer doing what you love to do. You are watching yourself become worse at it. Or it's, you know, like, it was difficult to get in those main events at 34. Dude, really? I retired AA at 34.
Wow. Were you the oldest pro at the time?
I think so. You know, and this is like after a broken leg.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think maybe I could have squeaked out another strong year, but the truth was, you know, I'm on borrowed time ish. Right. And it wasn't the same anymore either. Like it was just, I liked racing, but I wasn't getting as much out of it. And, you know, even though I had a good sponsor with Haro, like that last year, I wasn't with Haro. So it was like kind of putting the deal together and figuring, like, it just was, you know, it got tiresome.
Okay. Then let me ask you this. What went first for you, physical or mental?
So this is where it was a bit, I would say physical. Wow. because I was good with training. I was good with nutrition. I'm knock on wood, blessed a bit genetically. So I had a lot of things working for me, but the truth was, like, I just wasn't as fast as I was that, you know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
That's just the truth. Even though I was faster, everyone else was like that much faster.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? So, so my improvements were good, but I don't know that it was enough to keep going. Like, in hindsight, I probably should have trained a bit less, rested a bit more, and been a little bit more specific with my racing, but I was still trying to do it all.
Yes,
and then this is also now we have downhill, or not downhill BMX, we have Supercross BMX coming into it, which changed the game, which is like this hill. So now, I mean, they've got it figured out now, but back then, like, I'm like, why is Mike Day next to me on the first straightaway? I mean, nothing take away from him, but he would even tell you, like, the hill is a game changer for him too, in that he's next to me on the first straightaway.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you know, if we're both go out there right now and just run in a straight line, I'm dropping them.
Wow.
You know,
because
that's how much the hill at the time.
Yeah.
At the time, because if you had a decent pop and you got to that drop, it's like, you know that, and that was the whole point of the hill, is to keep people closer together to make racing more exciting. But it made it more exciting, but also more dangerous at the time and scary for me, because, like, now, you know, so it's all this adjustment, and do I want to do the Olympic thing? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff, and I'm in school, so that got pretty crazy, and I'm kind of like watching. And I'm knowing this is kind of the end of my career. So some guys managed to do it, like a Tomas Allier and a Christian, they kind of held on and got that Olympic experience. But for me, the Pan Am Games was kind of my kind of big goodbye, even though I raced a year later.
Gold medal.
So anyways, so yeah, it was emotionally tough at times, but it also was easy because I did have this schooling, and I did have a plan, and I did have the same mindset that went toward creating this new career that I did while I was racing.
Yeah.
So I just approached it. I remember talking to Romero about it, So I worked at a marketing company for a little bit as a brand manager. And,
in Chicago?
So I went to Chicago. That was like my first kind of like business trip for the company, but the company was in San Diego. But it was hilarious. I remember going on this interview. I was looking for internships actually in my psych world. And I came across this job thing. I'm like, I could probably do that. And I just started filling it out. Next thing I know, I'm getting interviewed, getting called in. And I'm on the gate at the ABA Grands. And I remember it's like second mode. I'm thinking, I think I'm going to get that job. I think they're going to give me that was pretty much, so it was cool though. I left BMX racing and jumped right into a manager position at a marketing company, doing all right. Kind of 55, 60 grand, just like out the box, like just on some whatever.
Yeah.
And I just needed to buy time to finish school anyways. But I remember talking to Romero saying, yeah, I want to be, my plan is to be as good of a psychologist as I was a racer. Yeah. I don't know how to measure that, but that was the way I approached it. Yep. So going into those internship interviews, going into like any interview I had, I was just like, boom, boom, boom. But if you think about it, how many times has someone stuck a camera in front of my face? How many times has someone put a microphone in front of my face? How many times I had to do a seminar or clinic with kids, right? And I'd started this when I was 16, doing a clinic, teaching kids and adults how to pull up for a tabletop or how to get a gate start. And so being able to present and represent myself in front of people was like, it didn't even matter what the job was. But now I'm 35, 36 doing this, and I'm going up against some 20 something who didn't have any work experience and just out of school and never had their privates on the chopping block. Please. Like, done. Donezo.
Wow.
Yeah. And on top of that, in psychology, the irony is I'm male and I'm black. Game over. Because there's not many of us.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So let me ask you this then. Going in 2012 at the Olympics, you've transitioned from the racer to the sports psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a keen eye on how to guide racers through whatever they're facing at an important race. Was that difficult for you to get that to them, to racers to understand?
It was pretty cool because the benefit I had was, so in 2012, there were some people that I had raced.
Yeah.
Still. I mean, almost up to like 20, like even 2016, there were some people that I raced.
Wow.
I raced Nick Long. We raced each other.
Yeah.
It might have been like a year of overlap, but that's pretty crazy. I raced, like me and Maris Stromberg did a lot of laps against each other.
Wow.
Right. And so I had the trust. It's like, okay, this dude knows what I'm going through on the gate as I walk up the hill for the semi or the main.
Yeah.
Right. And then I had this education to back it up and the papers. So in many cases, I was the obvious choice to be the person to call. So I ended up working with a lot of Olympians in our sport.
Yeah.
Whether it was specifically to help them get to the Olympics or just kind of help them through other stuff in their life or help them keep performing, in the national series or whatever thing they're doing.
Yeah.
That's probably the most fun part for me is being able to, I don't say teach, but help these riders learn the game. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And learn, and not only just learn the like racecraft, because their racecraft is keen, but their racecraft, yes, and also lifecraft, meaning how do we fit this into the bigger picture and still maintain a high level? And what does that look like?
Are there a lot of elite riders receptive to what you are offering them?
Yes, and it's gotten even better. It's gotten even better in that I think the conversation has changed from a like globally or, in the conversation's changed in general. So like this last Olympic cycle, Tokyo, the gymnast Dawes?
Biles.
Biles. Sorry. I'm aging myself, but yeah, Biles. pulling out, and then, you know, Weight of Gold, Michael Phelps talking about mental health issues and what that's like.
Yeah.
And it's kind of something I've been preaching the whole time, but athletes, and make rightfully so, are focused on performance. And so in many cases, we will forego what's good for us for what's good for us.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yes,
so, but because the conversation has changed and because it's in the limelight, I think people are understanding how your overall well-being can really not only help you perform, but actually help you look at yourself in the mirror and be good with who you are.
Yeah.
And so that's been my jam the whole time. But because of the natural occurrence of events in life and politically and blah, 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 I think that's really, you know, knock on wood, but that I'm seeing not just an uptick in my career, but just an uptick in people's seeking out good coaching or good mentorship or good therapist, like really seeking out, you know, a solid way to move forward.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm here for.
Okay. So then that leads me to my next question of why are you not involved heavily with the national team or even just the coach? Because you bring two things. You bring the race experience and then you bring the sports psychology to it. Why are you not in that position?
I think it boils down to budget. I think I'm biased, but I have, there's a couple reasons, right? So I'm not going to, so firstly, right, I talked about my race group, but
yes, sir.
But the other side of it is I have always been outspoken as an athlete. Okay. And as a young athlete, I probably didn't choose my words as well or hold back in the right areas. Okay. Whether it was with Johan at the UCI or with ABA or NBL. So I was always advocating for the riders for sure. But, you know, clearly, you know, I was making waves, right? So if I'm gonna be real, like, I got to atone for that. I should say I got to accept that there's some people who just might not accept that I might have grown or evolved from that, or they just, you know, they don't want somebody who's going to like be in their ear about like why, you know, making changes all the time. I mean, that's just on the real. So I'm taking responsibility for that side of it. The other side of it is I do believe I'm grossly underutilized on a bigger scale for this sport.
Yes.
That I can't tell you exactly why, but I do, you know, Jamie's been trying and working to get me in when he can.
Yeah.
The other thing is the athletes, and with USA Cycling, I mean, a lot of the athletes kind of have their own coaches, their own kind of psychologists, or the, you know, kind of like, so his program is to help this group of USA riders with their programs and then come together at a race like a Worlds or a World Cup and, you know, help get results. So it's a bit, you know, it's easier to just say, why aren't you this? But there's that. I mean, you know, yeah, best case scenario. Yeah. I probably it does make sense for a person like me to be traveling with the team and, you know, working at USA Cycling, but they have my number. They will refer athletes to me. But usually it just comes down to dollars. And, you know, at the end of the day, if an athlete will spend the dollar on training versus, you know, talking it out with someone like me. And at the end of the day, they're going to spend the money on getting two extra or three extra riders to the races versus having me go. And I get that. So it's, you know, the funding is kind of its own thing. So, but what I can say is I'm pleased to know that, you know, at least USA Cycling is, you know, has got a BMXer in there, running the BMX program and has performed at a high level and understands all these aspects and is sensitive to all those aspects. So, and the other thing is the Olympic Training Committee.
Yeah.
They have a sports psych that is, and several that they kind of have on staff that will go to events and they're maybe assigned to certain sports. So they already, they do have a person that does what I do, but they're, I don't want to say they're a generalist, but they cover more sports.
Yeah.
So, you know, and those positions are few and far between. And then candidly, do I want to give up what I'm doing? Cause I still get to work with athletes. I'm, you know, I have, you know, three mountain bikers and working with, you know, a couple BMXers and then some entrepreneurs, and then I'm speaking. So it's kind of like, you know, for me to do that, it really has to be worth it. Not just from a financial standpoint, but just worth it. Like time wise, commitment wise, all the other stuff.
Yeah.
I love BMX though. And it doesn't take much to get me to a race. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, those are all the components as to why I may not be doing that.
You've written several books.
Just two. More, Better, Happier. Yep.
And it's all BS.
Yep.
Talk to me about the process of writing a book, especially for what you're doing, because to me, the thing that's, I always find interesting is for someone to take it from here through the arm and put it on paper.
Oh yes. Yeah. So, the first process was interesting in that I was fortunate to do a seminar with a colleague of mine on belief systems. And I wrote that. Dr. Arwin, the tool that we use, the belief matrix. So he's kind of chapter 8. That's why he's, I don't know about co-author, but definitely like written with him, or he helped. So that was basically, let's take this seminar and then outline it and then kind of go through the seminar on paper. And then I'll throw in some stories and anecdotes to fill in. That was how that process worked.
Yeah.
More, Better, Happier is completely, and by the way, so I wrote that and it wasn't, and I still, and then I re-released it because there was some things in there that bothered me. A couple mistakes grammatically, a couple typos, and I wanted to update a couple areas and just kind of clean it up and then redo the cover. So I re-released it. More, Better, Happier, same thing. Written, and I'm not going to re-release it. It's just going to be a running change, but I open it up. It's like, oh, you know, I probably could have done this. So it's an iterative process. So just like your college textbook, it's like, you know, there's the different versions of the college tech book. Same thing with this. You know, my name's on it. I have the nerve to put doctor in front of my name and have an MBA as well. And so I see mistakes, and I'm sure somebody reads like, this fool's a doctor. But content wise, it is all from thousands of hours of conversations with hundreds of people, coupled with my experience, education, and how I put it all together.
Yeah.
Like how I put it together, not only for other people, but for myself too. So like in all BS, you'll see more references. You'll see more footnotes. In this, I'm just like flowing, like boom, 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 boom. Like I have like maybe two references in there, official references. I am, you know, because More, Better, Happier is literally a psychologist letter to his kids disguised as leadership. And how that started was I was writing the intro. So I started it the same way I start any other book, which is I come up with a chapter outline and then I kind of write papers to each chapter. And on the acknowledgement, and it just was going to be like a quick, you know, thanks to so-and-so. But as I'm writing this, like my dad's got cancer and we're looking at the last, you know, year-ish, two-ish, I'm going through some stuff, you know, with struggling with my own, you know, like entrepreneurship business stuff and also trying to raise these two young kids and, you know, like life is happening.
Yes, sir.
And so I'm writing this and I'm writing it and I'm just like, this is a pretty big acknowledgement section, you know? And so that's not the, so anyway, so I was like, oh my gosh. So then as I started to sit down and put this book together, I'm like, you know, that's that's kind of more the purpose of this, right? This is what would I want my kids to know and implement, you know, like this, like who is their dad, right? They see me as possibly a disciplinarian or maybe the mean guy or the guy who's always like on them about, you know, rules or whatever. And they see bits and pieces of my professional life and they see me online and all that stuff. But they still know me as their dad. And so this is like me exposing myself to them in a way that's like, hey guys, like, I'm not saying be like me, but apply this to you.
Yeah.
Right. And move forward. And the cool thing is, right, disguised as leadership, I'm writing to them and you. I'd want you to know this too, yeah. Right? I'd want you to implement this too. I'd want you to, by the way, not everything, but one or two things, just one thing, you know, one thing that'll make your life that you can do right now. There's one thing I'm sure in this book that you can do that will make your life better. I'm positive. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so that's how it started. And so I have it split into, you know, I kind of take our current kind of events, specifically in the US, how we're arguing about everything from race to, you know, all this kind of class stuff and how, you know, I'm not going to say it's designed. I'm not going to get into conspiracy theories or anything like that. But the bottom line is, I think a lot of us are looking at reasons why we're not as successful as we want to be versus maybe looking at ourselves. And I stand by that. And I'm guilty of that too. I'm guilty of that too, because it's really easy to point the fingers, but it's like, well, hey, wait, what are you doing in yourself that doesn't make sense? What are you saying that you haven't thought fully through? You know, those kinds of things. Like, I know racism exists, but I can't deny the fact that we had a black president for two terms either. So like, he did something. Okay.
Yeah.
He did something. What did he do?
Yeah.
What did he do? And so I'm asking you to ask yourselves these questions so that you're not walking around the world blaming, right? And that you're taking accountability and agency over your, as best you can, your outcomes. Because the thing is like, and I, you know, and so I get into that and I get into, you know, some using examples, right? I'm not trying to solve these big world issues, but I'm using this as like a pattern interrupt to say, look, like there's a lot of conflict in the world. There's a lot of conflict in the world. Okay. I get that. We still can't deny the fact that you're here and you probably want something.
Yeah.
Probably. And I'm guessing it probably revolves around more, better, or happier, right? You want more of something. You want to be better at something. You probably want to be decently pleased with how you're living your life, right? That's it. So let's rearrange that playing field so that you can do that. And that's what this book does, is it helps you rearrange that playing field so you can work toward the more, better, happier. I don't know what it is everyone wants, but they want something.
Okay. So my thought to that is, you're putting so much out to help everybody else. Is there someone that you talk to that helps you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, like I said, I worked with a sports psych for a long time. And I had, you know, over my course of my career, I've had mentors that I paid for that I just naturally had. You know, I've had the benefit of having a good support network,
yeah,
my friends and family, my wife. I definitely acknowledge her influence on me in there. Good, bad, and indifferent. But yeah, I mean, definitely. And even getting through this and getting it to market, I was working with a coach, and he was awesome. I mean, he was awesome and just kind of like bouncing all of this and him helping me kind of organize my own thoughts around all this stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I've also self-trained. Like I keep, you know, I keep this book, and this book is conversations, and this book is my ideas, and this book, you know, like the first page of this book, straight up, this is like a meditation that I do. Like I walk this down, like, and this is something, you know, we talk about that when I was 16 and, you know, the Auburn van showed up at my house, like,
yeah,
I did a version of this not knowing it, but I was just kind of up late at night listening to music and just like thinking about all these things in my life that were about to happen. And like, it wasn't sad, but I was like, I remember like welling up because I was just like filled with so much like charged emotion around it. And like, and so no wonder I went off on that summer and just like went on a tear.
Yeah.
Because like, not only was it just like out there in the world energetically, but like I was really practicing gratitude. I didn't know that. I was really like meditating on that, not knowing that. But yeah, another book full of stuff. But, you know, and so I, you know, this triangle, like that's me working my stuff out. Like, you know, all the tools that I use with my athletes or with my clients or even in a workshop.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm the petri dish for a lot of it. I put it to use for myself. I'm not a do as I say, not as I do. Like I'm doing it. You're doing the work.
Yeah. I know you're a busy man, so I want to wrap this up, but I have a question that I want to ask you, and I'm not sure if you're a religious man or not. And I don't think necessarily this is for that. It is, does Dr. Jason Richardson, after looking at the totality of your life so far to where you are, I know you got a birthday coming up. Do you feel blessed? Yes or no? And why?
Yes. 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 Emphatically. Yes. I cannot deny the fact that I was born into the family I was born into, that I probably came up more Cosby, like Huxtable, I should say, than, you know, some of my other brothers and sisters, you know what I mean? Like I can't, but I also have like this rich, like cultural piece where my mom's from Pakistan and, you know, all these things, and I don't know why, but for some reason, when all the stuff goes through the filter in my head, I tend to put that optimistic spin on it. Dare I say even a bit naive, but I just happen to see things in a what could be, not in a what could be bad, but like possibility standpoint. And where that comes from, dude, I don't know. I have family members. They don't have that outlook all the time. You know what I mean? We're different. So that's something I can't deny. Now, what do I do with that? Well, I suppose I could do that and just like, and there is a selfish side of me, and I could probably use those powers to like create some company and just like sell some whatever snake oil and like just make a lot of money and blah, 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 blah. I could do that. But I don't think that's, well, one, I don't know that I'd be happy or fulfilled doing that. But two is I think because of that, my luck, right? Because I'm here and because of my luck, I think it's my responsibility as best I can to share it and let others know that, or see that there is a way or another way or a different perspective. So to get a bit spiritual, like, you know, is it a God? Is it an energy? I would say yes and yes. I do believe we all have the ability, you know, barring, you know, really the edges of like actual intelligence and IQ and all that stuff, because there are some people who have problems that are beyond, you know, their own agency.
Yes, sir.
But I do think most of us can really plug in. And I mean, plug into the world, like put your feet on the ground and really start to not only feel what's there, but also like start like being that powerful person that can like create something, right? Whether it's a movement, whether it's a different life for yourself, whether it's a better life for your family, you know, something. So when I go deep, and this is something that I help people do like through the process, through performance. But I mean, that is how I succeeded. Like I is like being honest with that and plugging myself into that. and just like plugging myself into the world. And like I said, like that night before I got on, you know, got on the Auburn band, like I remember it was like almost a spiritual moment, just kind of like really feeling the, at the time, the enormity of it and being, and letting that kind of, you know, drip over me and like feeling that and allowing that, being, you know, in such gratitude of it.
Yeah.
Right. And honoring that, and then going out and just like experiencing that, like I was plugged in. When I go, when that's how I made so many world main events. You look on paper, like I'm, and if you watch me race, like back in the day, like I'm a much better rider now. I'm not as fast down the first straight, but I'm a much better rider where I was now than I was then. And you look at some laps, like there's no good reason for me to have done as well as I did.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that I somehow figured out how to way to plug myself in.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And so my job is to help you plug in.
Wow. Well, Dr. Jason Richardson, I want to say thank you for giving me the time to come on the Lane 8 BMX podcast. It's been a blessing.
Yeah, well, thank you. Lane 8, man, a lot happens out there.
That's why I named it that. I you know, everybody's afraid of it. Nah, man, yeah. Take it on as a challenge.
No, I like it. No one's cutting you off in Lane 8. Well, Terry T might. He'll windshield. He used to have this. He used to say I'll play it Mercedes windshield wiper, because back in the day they had that one windshield wiper.
Yes,
and it had that jog in it.
Yeah.
And Terry would, he did. That's how dope Terry Tenet was. Is he could be in seven, cut you off in eight, and then still get over to the first turn. That's how dope he was. He played Mercedes windshield wiper. Boom boom.
All right. Thank you again. I always appreciate it.
All right, man. Peace.
You got it.